The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
The talk is on how the 1950s became the 1960s, and I think just to say the two decades, 50s and 60s, like really evokes immediate images, you know, the 50s of conformism, of McCarthyism and the anti-communist witch hunts, the 60s of radicalism, of experimentation, freedom, rock and roll, you know, they just really counterposed images. And the point of talking about from the 1950s to the 1960s is, first of all, to defend the 1960s against the 1950s, because there's plenty of voices, especially now in American politics, who have a good idea of what was happening in the 1950s, but also who heap abuse on the 1960s, not just by conservatives, but by liberals too. There's a caricature of, you know, the 1960s being a decade of pampered youth acting out, you know, and going, you know, doing things that they didn't even really understand, but just being rebellious for rebellion's sake. I mean, I don't know what it's like now. When I was first, you know, when I was in college and becoming a radical, there used to be these articles all the time, like, you know, it was a protest and it was a scene out of the 60s. These demonstrators, they were just after the 1960s fix. Which was made it really funny when I was reading an article from the time of the early 1960s struggles, and it was people being extremely frustrated, being accused of only wanting their 1930s fix, the struggles of the 1930s, the union struggles. You know, so it really, the truth of the matter is that the 1960s was the key decade of modern politics, at least up until the 21st century, a profound challenge to the system of the rulers and the ruled, especially by 1968. And this is a talk is in a series on that. Sherry Wolf just spoke in the last meeting that I think some folks recognize we're at about one of the high points of that. You know, but really in the United States, you know, just as colossal transformations that stopped a war, the Vietnam War, the struggles of the 1960s, at least by 1975, it took a little while, but it transformed, you know, the power of U.S. imperialism, that destroyed the system of Jim Crow in the Jim Crow apartheid in the South, and it did result in a vast development of state-sponsored programs and initiatives, the war on the poor that we fight to defend today, that, you know, has taken a 40-year offensive, neoliberal offensive, to try to dismantle those things, to take away those gains that you know, are in Trump's sights right now. Plus, much, much more. Women's liberation becomes, you know, an issue. The really advanced question of women's role in society. You know, the gay and lesbian liberation movement emerges on a mass scale for the first time. That's one thing that it's important to say, but also, how did one get to the other? How did you get from the 1950s to the 1960s, you know, in a very quick period of time, a profound contrast, and in particular, how a core of people who were at the heart of the struggles that really did transform the situation, how they found each other, how they got involved in the struggle, how they found each other, how they knitted together a new left, which is really important for our you know, discussion today. You know, the 1950s, you know, you have this image. There's a movie called Far From Heaven that I always think of when I think of the 1950s. It's in a single, I think it's confined to a single suburb, you know, a single white suburb, and yet it's about racism and anti-gay. You know, it's an incredible movie, and the entire movie, I think, when I think back on it, is filmed with this kind of blue filter that really just gives you the imminent sense of, like, a cold, you know, of people's division from each other. You know, when I think of 1960s, I think of exactly the opposite. I think of a rock concert. I think of, like, you know, the heat and the energy of people really having come alive. And that, I think, is the most important lesson of the 1960s, is just that people do and can come alive. You know, their conclusions may not have survived the fall and the receding of the movement. For every turncoat like Jerry Rubin and some of the other people we'll talk about who have grabbed headlines by becoming a right winger, there's people who remember from that era what it was that changed them. There's a quote in a book about Freedom Summer, one of the stories I'll talk about, the Freedom Summer initiative during the 1964 and the civil rights movement of volunteers going down to the South. And this is what one of those volunteers told Doug McAdam. "The memories of that summer are very important to me because they serve as a reminder to me that there are qualities in me that are worth something and that people are capable of quite remarkable things. It's the single most enduring moment of my life. I believe in it beyond anything." I get choked up when I hear it because you hear invested in that, how we got from the 1950s to the 1960s, because people like that transform themselves, and that's the raw ingredients for the revolution that we look forward to in the future. So go back to the decade of the 1950s. You know, I mean, politically it's characterized by the anti-communism hysteria driven by Senator Joseph McCarthy out of Wisconsin, but not just the Republican right. The Democrats as well had their version of McCarthyism. People are probably more familiar with the purges that took place in Hollywood of, you know, writers, directors, actors called before the House Un-American Activities Committee and asked to name names, and if they didn't name names, they were blacklisted. The truth is that happened throughout the labor movement. It wasn't just a Hollywood thing, but it was the way in which people's careers, people's lives were ruined throughout the period. The economic basis on which that developed was the midst of a long period of a post-war expansion of the economy, especially in the United States, in which economic crisis, all of the problems of the capitalist economy were muted for most people, importantly, not everybody, not for African Americans especially, but for most people they were more muted than they were. And this gave rise to the idea and the reality of the American dream. You might not be able to become a Rockefeller, but you could expect that you would be able to live a better life in 10 years, that your kids would be able to live a better life, that they might be able to go to college, which is another enormously important transformation. The expansion of higher education is critical because not just out of the goodness of anyone's heart to open the thing up, but because capitalism needed a more educated working class, you know, for the economy of the future. Really important there. But this period of the American dream set the tone that was reflected in culture of the period of suburbanization and the Leave It to Be. I don't know if anyone ever sees this TV show anymore, Leave It to Beaver, but it's like the almost unbelievably stultified nuclear family in the suburbs that you can imagine. I think that really explains, you know, these surveys that you can find from this is actually from the very beginning of the 1960s. Among young male students, 40% could think of no way at all that they wanted to be different in any way from their father, all right? Among women, there was a survey of 50 sophomore women. 46 out of the 50 sophomore women in college expected that they would get married to a professional or a junior executive, live in the suburbs, and have 3 or 4 kids. And of course, working was out of the question. I mean, that's the kind of, you know, conservatism, and it's felt across the spectrum. That, I think, is really important, that, you know, that the ideologies of the center-left or the labor-based parties in Europe and in the United States, the Democratic Party, converged with the ideologies of the center-right. And within the labor movement, you had the rise and the predominance of business unionism, with members' interests aligned with the corporations, you know, even on the left, you know, even on the left, the idea that the working class, the ideas, the dominant ideas of socialism, that the working class could struggle and change society were under attack on the left. An emphasis on the idea of consumerism and cultural conformism. But that, if that was the surface appearance and the predominant idea of what was going on in society, there was also clear that there were a lot going on underneath the thing. First of all, the boom that it produced, this unprecedented growth that it produced and been the basis on which the American dream could have some reality, did raise expectations for a generation of people who, you know, had been brought up in the 1930s, in the middle of the Great Depression and the Second World War. And that could be largely contained as long as the expansion continued, but increasingly, there were signs of strains on this kind of economic motor that drove things. And most of all, on campuses, because this, again, I will say, the expansion of higher education is absolutely crucial thing, from being in a vacation for the ruling class to people of all classes attending. And I think the thing that's important is that didn't change the wider class structure. It meant that people of all classes began to be able to attend college, but they were going to all classes. They were not going to that sinecure of the ruling class or the upper middle class that a supervised society, but we're going to all classes. And then the promise that higher education would be a way to explore the world, to think about the world, make your own way in it, that promise began to crack in various ways. And that, I think, is really important in understanding what the fissures were, the promises that are broken. It's really, really important for the most important struggle of all of the 1950s and 1960s, which is the civil rights movement. The promise exposed, because here is the greatest democracy in the world, preached over and over, supposed to be the light of the world in the face of communism, the Russia, the totalitarianism of Stalinism, unless you happen to be black and live in the American South, in which case you live under apartheid conditions. You can't vote, any of those things. And the civil rights movement had its roots in this. Like, you had African Americans brought into the army during the Second World War, the desegregation of the army, fighting a war for democracy, fighting a war against Nazism, in defense of democracy, come home to a segregated society. And that begins to lay the roots, the cracks in the monolith. We'll talk more about that in a second, but even more widely than that, some of the ideas of anti-communism began to be challenged. In 1954, Robin Hood, the story Robin Hood, was banned for supposedly being pro-communist in Indiana. So I think it was in Indiana. And Indiana University students began selling pins with a green feather on it as a sign of protest. And it actually spread across the country. There was a demonstration of some thousands of students in UCLA, which is right down the street from Hollywood, right at the moment when the purges are taking place in Hollywood. Another example is that, and this might be hard for people to know about, I have some taste of it, having grown up on the tail end of this era, of the terror of nuclear war. The actual real thought, I can remember waking up and thinking, from a dream that was a nightmare about nuclear weapons being used. And so there was all kinds of ways in which, they had civil defense drills, like, which were supposed to, like, protect you. You had to, go to shelters, and if you were a student, you would hide under your desk. This would be an excellent way to protect yourself from a nuclear annihilation, right? So, pacifists in the 1950s in New York City actually challenged this by refusing to take shelter during the civil defense drills. And they were arrested and taken away for doing this. By 1960, the spring drill was coming under more, in the schools was coming under attack. Hundreds of college students refused to participate in the civil defense drills, stood outside their campuses. High school students refused to get under the desks. And this is what a student who was suspended for doing this told the New York Post. The teacher stood in the corridor and told us we were mixing up the other students and making the school unorganized. We said that it was the only way to let the kids know that hiding under a desk was not the way to avoid getting killed. I mean, you know, that is to, and that's to only focus on some of the most political expressions of, you know, the thing, because you can see the ferment as well culturally, especially culturally, even in the 1950s of some of the music of jazz and the rise of bebop as a different and challenging form of jazz, and jazz seen as like a real art form and performed by artists, and of course rock and roll, which in particular had the contrast, the reaction to the repressed sexuality of the 1950s. So, you know, it's hard to even conceive of the fact that Elvis's hips were, you know, a challenge to the cultural thing. But, you know, and that actually gives rise to the first level of rebellion for lots of people. It's not articulated very well. It's, you know, on the basis of bitterness and alienation. But it was seen as a generation gap between young and old. And you don't want to overstate this, because there's always, you know, a rebellion against parental authority, as parents in the room will know. There was a different basis for a different kind of generation gap in the 1950s and 60s, because this is the period of the rise of a mass culture, and in particular of a youth culture in which the products of cultural products were being marketed back to youth, cultural products that could express rebellion, you know, against the seemingly unjust authority, even at the level of the unjust authority of a parent. But that gets connected to a whole range of other things, which when you think about Bob Dylan or something like that, begins to like connect that with, you know, against the old, begins to connect that with much more political concerns, which means that this is actually unique from previous generations, that the experience of millions of youth, previously a very isolated experience within the family, was something that was being expressed outside of it in mass culture. So that in a way that all of these isolated individuals could identify with this primary level of rebellion and attach themselves and identify themselves with the new in that sense. Anyway, don't mean to go on too long on some of that. Those were the ideas, the spirit, the climate that was swirling around, but not yet a movement. Still only a minority of people who were embracing even the vaguest cultural expressions, in the 1950s. So the question is, how did this climate of simmering discontent get translated into action? And, you know, the thing is that it may look obvious when you look back and read the history, you know, that the lid is about to be lifted off. The world is about to be turned upside down, but people don't realize it at the time. Betty Denich decided to join one of the socialist organizations, the Young People's Socialist League, in late 1959, and she said later that she saw it as kind of an existential gesture. She said, I was reading Camus, and I thought, well, you can't hope much will come out of it, but still, what are you going to do with your life? And so she joined the socialists. Within a few months, Betty Denich and Yipsel in Berkeley were organizing thousands of students to picket at the Woolworth store in solidarity with the young blacks who sat in at the lunch counters across the South and asked to be served a cup of coffee and were refused. You know, just suddenly, and from that point really, the 1960s were on, at least in Berkeley, and at least for that core of people who had come around politics and consciously identified themselves as that. In fact, the decisive struggle for the whole of the 1960s was the civil rights movement. And one reason for that is it was already a movement. By the by the early 1950s, the first inklings of it were beginning to happen. And most spectacular, the Montgomery bus boycott of 1955 through 1957, where, of course, Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat to a white man, was arrested for it, and led to a boycott that remained solid, among the poor blacks of Montgomery for a period of about 15 months. So that movement had already begun to to take struggle in a different direction than some of the more legalistic ways of organizing for civil rights. People like Martin Luther King, but also people from different backgrounds like Ella Baker and Bayard Rustin becoming identified as leaders of the civil rights movement. The truth is that after 1957, the civil rights movement appeared to come to a crossroads. It didn't have the same kind of successes that the Montgomery bus boycott had, that it happened. But that actually was transformed by one event, which took place on February 1st, 1960, which was when four students from North Carolina A&T, historically black college, decided to go down to the Woolworths and ask to be served a cup of coffee. And it suddenly just, it galvanized people in a profound way. The numbers are that on first day, four people participated in the sit-in. Day two, 23. Day three, 63. By day four, there were 300 people trying to jam themselves into the Woolworths, to 400 young African Americans trying to jam themselves into the Woolworths to participate. And that, to make a long story short, spread like wildfire. Within 15 cities that had sit-ins within 2 weeks. This is the South, before the internet. Before, there was certainly no mass media talking about these sit-ins, right? 15 cities across the South within 2 weeks, 100 cities by the end of a year. The civil rights movement was transformed suddenly by this injection of the spirit and energy of youth. And it also threw up new organization. In April of 1960, Ella Baker, who has worked with the Southern Christian Leadership Conference of Martin Luther King, pulled together leaders of the student movement and formed the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which really is the key organization of the new left of that era, an organization that could harness the energy of the young. And in a very brief period, in a period of 2, 3, 4 years, you had the most amazing story unfold. You know, the SNCC activists participating in the Freedom Rides, where they got on interstate bus lines that were supposed to be to desegregate those, and were brutally attacked and forced the attention of the nation onto the question of voting rights activism, of demanding that voting rights, which were viciously repressed by Jim Crow racism, would be allowed. This is just what, three years and 3 months later, came the March on Washington, with 250,000 people in Washington, D.C., brought from around the country, but an incredible outpouring of civil rights activism. And of course, we know the story about, everyone knows the story, I would think, about Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech, which was a tremendous speech. But what we don't know as much about is the role that SNCC played. By that point, they were a major player in the civil rights movement, and one that was beginning to voice the questions on the leading edge. How do we get there? We've done these things. We've put ourselves on the line. What do we do to get to the next step? Because they keep attacking us. They keep beating us down. So John Lewis, a leader of SNCC, was the speaker for SNCC at the March on Washington. His speech was demanding to know what the Kennedy administration, the Democratic Kennedy administration, which talked about civil rights on occasion, but did nothing to actually enforce them. What were they going to do about it? And his speech was actually censored by other members of the movement, including King, who thought he was going too far, that this was not the time and place to raise this. But you can see how that is leading, you know, an organization that was formed first out of students going down to the lunch counter to take this basic act of civil disobedience. We're becoming much more radical. We're becoming, in fact, revolutionary. 64 was the turning point for SNCC, because it involved, first of all, the Mississippi Summer Project, known as Freedom Summer, where the work that black civil rights workers had done in trying to register blacks to vote and to make voting actually a right, and had been beaten down and brutalized by the Jim Crow system, SNCC calculated that if we brought along some white students to be brutalized along with them, maybe they would have to react in a different way. And it was absolutely true. Succeeded massively by bringing in volunteers from the North. The 1964 presidential campaign had more coverage as a news story that year than Freedom Summer. It was a transformative event. And SNCC was right. It did actually force the feds to step in a different way. at the end of the summer was another pivotal event for SNCC, and Haley Pessin talked about it in a session yesterday, the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party's challenge at the 1964 1964 Democratic Party convention. The Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party was a slate of delegates elected to sit as the Mississippi delegates instead of the all-white Jim Crow delegation that was elected in the official things. And so there was actually apparent endorsements from numerous Democratic Party figures. But then the backroom deals began. The effort to work out a compromise that was really no compromise at all. Two people from the delegation able to sit as observers, right? Well, the Lily White official delegation sat in the convention. And this was not forced on the MFDP by the racist terrorists of the South. It was worked out in the back room by the liberal leaders of the party, the people who talked about civil rights. So it became the final straw for a lot of these activists. Cleveland Sellers, another SNCC member, said, "Never again would be lulled into believing that our task was exposing injustices so that the good people of America would eliminate them." You know, horizons opened up once again in a new debate and discussion about how to change society and what kind of change. That is just a brief look, but I wanted to make this outline to talk about how a new left changes, that how that final straw for SNCC veterans meant that people who had been intent on reform, who had come to the movement thinking that if only we show what's happening in the South, there will be a response and we'll get our rights, had become people who are questioning the Democratic Party, who are questioning the whole structure of society, who are becoming revolutionaries, and trying to figure out what power was possible in a whole number of other ways. I've gone on way longer than I expected to, so I'm going to have to skip around a little bit in some of the rest of this story. SNCC and the struggle in the South was the crucible, but there were other movements that followed more slowly, more years behind the process, and they were particularly around the question of the Vietnam War, that developed through the course of the 1960s. Go back to Berkeley for a second. The apparent calm, was broken by those solidarity protests in 1960 outside the Woolworths stores. A few months later, the House Un-American Activities Committee, that McCarthyite body, was to hold hearings in San Francisco, and so Berkeley students called for protest. But it was different because there was a wider audience that had met each other, that had come together in struggle. In this one instance, were brought together around this other issue. So Betty Denich talks about how the fact that all these people who had been out picketing Woolworths and understood that kind of politics meant that when the call goes out, let's picket City Hall against the House Un-American Activities Committee, bang, instead of getting a couple of dozen of the regulars out, you got thousands out. And right there, you see how you begin to knit together that new left, how the connections that are made at one level of the struggle come back again. There's discontinuities in all kinds of different ways. There are breaks in the pattern, but that's something that's really critical in understanding how a new left forms in the course of struggle, in the course of that activity. And by the way, on the second day of those anti-HUAC protests in San Francisco, the cops were called in. And so Northern students got their first taste of billy clubs and tear gas and the repression of the police. And that's something that they wouldn't forget or forgive, And from that point on, Berkeley, of all places, certainly it was the citadel, it was the flashpoint for the radicalization in the North and among youth, that was a political place with ebbs and flows, but a constant culture of protests. I can't go through all of those protests, and it's a shame because it means that the Vietnam War is left out of this, because I wanted to focus on the civil rights movement. There's a development in the way in which the Vietnam War becomes central, and also in Congress with that, at the same time as that, is a set of issues that are also about the university itself. right? That people are beginning to be outraged by what is done in the name of the United States and the American flag and all this in Vietnam. At the same time, they're recognizing how the campuses are complicit with this in the form of, you know, military contracts, of recruitment, and so forth. And also other issues that exist on the campus. The free speech movement in Berkeley that began in 1964 was basically against a clampdown on civil rights organizing on campus. And students who had accepted the rules before were no longer willing to do so. And that brought people together. So, if you think about it, movements at the start are pushed forward by this explosion of discontent and bitterness that new people flood in. It spreads like wildfire. There's attempts to make links, to plan for more of the same. But at a certain point, just like for SNCC, just like for the Berkeley students, and for students in general, the question of politics enters in. Politics meaning just this: what next? What do we do next? Whatever we might have won, we need to move beyond that, and what's going to take us there? Because you think of SNCC as already an organization well into its life, an organization comes up against the fantastic success of Freedom Summer in terms of exposing, the nature of the problem in the South, and yet you don't win the actual change. You don't see the actual change taking place. So what comes next? If the Democrats aren't the solution to the problem, if we can't win those Northern Democrats, what do we do next? How do we exercise our power in a different way? And the movement has to come up with a political explanation, even if it doesn't call it that. And that's where the politics of the past, the traditions of the past, are really important, where the socialist tradition becomes very important, because that represents the accumulated experience and knowledge of past struggles, of generations of past struggles that may have to contend with new issues like the fact of these students being around. That's a new question that the socialist movement has to pay attention to. But yet the importance of the lessons that were learned in the 1960s or in the 1840s and 50s with the abolitionist movement, or in the 19-teens in labor struggles and so forth, that's what the socialist movement can bring. That can be really crucial in answering and giving a positive direction to some of these movements. But the truth is that, and I'm going to have to cut this part of the story much shorter than I wish I could, and maybe we can talk more about it in discussion, is that what's important and unique about this situation in the late 1950s and early 1960s is how far removed the socialist tradition as it still existed in the United States was from these upsurges of struggle. And there are objective reasons for that. The McCarthyism was not just a bad time politically. It meant that left organization was crushed out of the unions. It was that organizations were beaten back and hammered. And plus, at the same time as that was taking place, at the same time as the left was being beaten back, the right within the workers' movement was going on the offensive. When you have the rise of business unionism, it's the identification that the best thing for workers is if the company succeeds. Right, and so we just need to organize. We'll negotiate contracts, but with this idea that cooperation is the best possible way. And so you had the unions retreating from the titanic struggles of the 1930s that built the mass industrial unions in this country into much more bureaucratic, deeply conservative, and often corrupt structures. So that for many of the people who were becoming radicalized at this time, instead of seeing working class power, and again, for people who were in the meeting in France about France, that became an immediate connection. In the United States, it wasn't so immediate because of the actual unique characteristics of the United States. So people, instead of coming, and seeing the possibility of workers' power defending these struggles for civil rights, for student rights on campus, against the war, they identify the unions for sure as being part of the problem, as being part of the conservative apparatus of the old left, and even the working class. So that has to do with partly with the the clampdown of McCarthyism, but it also has to do with the collapse of the old left, partly in part because of repression, but also because of the politics of Stalinism, the dominant socialist tradition that exists in the United States, looked to Russia as a socialist project, and that was for sure by the 1950s. By 1956, after Stalin's death, and Khrushchev, the next leader of the USSR, gave us the quote-unquote secret speech, which revealed all the horrific crimes of Stalinism that were committed in the name of socialism. You had a total disorientation as well politically of the large majority of the socialist movement. There was and always has been a tradition of socialism that we trace ourselves back to in the ISO, which always challenged the idea that Russia, after the rise of Stalin, was in any way still socialist, was in any way still a model for people to organize around. But it remained very, very small. The largest of them was actually an important organization that in some ways is our great-grandmother or something, because we do trace some of our lineage back to the Independent Socialist League, which joined the Socialist Party at the end of the 1950s, and in particular its youth group, the Young People's Socialist League, or the Yipsels as they were known. That was the group that Benny Denich joined in 1959. They had a particular political viewpoint that could have made more sense, that you can't celebrate the USSR as an impressive and dictatorial society as socialist, but you can't celebrate the West either. They actually were among the first to talk about neither Washington nor Moscow, but international socialism. That's where that idea that the ISO puts forward begins to come into play. Joel Geyer, Sam Farber, there are a couple other, as Dave Zirin put it, people who are part of these struggles in the 1960s who don't have Olympic medals, who are here this weekend, talks about this as one of the first new left organizations. And in the early 1960s, Yipsel shot up to a membership of 800 people. That could have actually been a real thing. But you also have to look at it, but it didn't. And part of the reason for that, which is too long to get into, is that it was embroiled in a bitter factional dispute at that particular moment, when one of the main leading figures of the organization that people looked to, a guy by the name of Max Shackman, suddenly moved away from socialism, quite suddenly moved away from socialist ideas into supporting, for example, the Bay of Pigs invasion of Cuba, which had just had its revolution 2 years earlier, an invasion of exiles that was supported and backed by the United States government. So you had this one organization that could have maybe tried to transmit that tradition was caught up in turmoil at that particular point. So the bottom line was that the new left spent its formative years without any kind of revolutionary socialist organization that was able to make its case, able to show its own activity and strategies, and politics to people coming around activity. Let's talk about SNCC for a second. And the other key figure of the new left is the Students for a Democratic Society, which I'm not going to be able to talk about, but fortunately Jeff, who's here, is going to be speaking on that in the next session. So I'm going to skip over a lot of that. But let's talk about SNCC, which was reaching these revolutionary conclusions, but with no one, in a situation where no one was able to put forward for example, the Communist Party's model of building a multiracial movement on the basis of class politics, but also fighting racism, which was one of the great achievements of the Communist Party. As many problems as it had with the Stalinist politics, was the tremendous activism that took place around anti-racist issues in the 1920s and 1930s. But that was missing from the equation. equation. So when black revolutionaries began to identify with socialism, they began to identify with socialism with the likes of people like Mao and Castro or Nkrumah in Ghana. Not at all the tradition of the revolutionary socialist tradition that the black and white revolutionaries of the Communist Party and the other revolutionaries had looked to. So that meant that the ideas of among the radical ideas, the ideas of black nationalism thrived, and they took on a very revolutionary form that's still inspirational and we draw from today. Very importantly, Malcolm X in the last year of his life changing some of his views about black separatism and beginning to move toward a different set of ideas. Frankly, Martin Luther King moving in very much the same direction by the end of his life and talking about the way in which class issues have to be bound together with the struggle for against racial discrimination and for civil rights. So you had those kind of things, especially in the Black Panther Party, a real mix and uncompromising opposition to oppression and injustice. There was a strand of black nationalism that was very conservative indeed, that was either cultural in nature or that actually supported the idea of black capitalism as the best way to have black power. And that was something that Richard Nixon, by the way, the conservative Republican president, could celebrate. I'm for black power if it means black capitalism. I'm running on too long. But that was so that was something that the revolutionary nationalism, the Panthers, stood out. But also disconnected, and there were actually important experiments within the Panthers of how to organize around working class issues in the factories and so forth. But it was also disconnected, there were also disconnected parts of that from the community organization. And when Stokely Carmichael, one of the leaders of SNCC, coined the idea of black power, it was given that very conservative definition by, the more conservative nationalists, but he gave it a more radical one, but it never really broke out of the bounds of the idea of building political power within the existing system. Some of the ideas of the socialist tradition that might have given an alternative to that, that might have shown a different way, actually weren't there. I can't really go on any longer, but I do want to not stop on that sad part of the story. I will say that the important part of that sad part of the story is that politics matter, that what we do matters. Timing is everything in politics, and if you're not there at the particular moment, you miss that opportunity. And the opportunity may come again, but it may not come again. And that's the important thing, is to make sure that we're an organization, that the other organizations, the socialists left today, whatever our differences, are of a sufficient size that when those struggles break out on an even larger basis than we're seeing them now, that we want to be a part of that. But I also want to just say one last thing about saying the importance of the transformation itself, even if its promise wasn't achieved. It really is hard to imagine life in the 1950s today. It's hard to watch Mad Men and go, what? I mean, I don't know if people watch it, right? It's hard to like even conceive of some of that, being a part of our lives today. It is possible to conceive of what we know of the 1960s and the transformation that exists in individual people's lives. That does feel like part of our life today. We need to make it more of a part of our life.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.